Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Morin Rout. And today we're looking at women's lives, actually, because we're going to play an interview I did with Ingrid Horrocks, who won the Ockham Major Prize, the fiction prize, just a week or so ago. And her book is entitled All Her Lives. It's a collection of short stories about women's lives. And as well as playing that, I'm also going to be talking to Wellington poet Dinah Hawken, who last year won the Prime Minister's Award for poetry. And of course, a woman's life in poetry.
Yeah, so I spoke with Lauren Keenan about her historical novel, The Other Catherine, which is based on the lives of two of her tupuna, and it really deals with the histories, with women's experience in colonial Aotearoa, a Pākehā convict ancestor and a Māori ancestor, and but their stories are woven together. It's beautiful. So, yes, indeed, women's lives, great theme. So, yeah, women's lives, definitely a great theme for today. The Other Catherine is the second historical novel by Lauren Keenan, exploring issues of Aotearoa's colonial history. Lauren is a celebrated writer of short stories, creative nonfiction, popular psychology, an historical guidebook, and children's literature. Lauren whakapapas to Te Atiawa ki Taranaki through her ancestor, Katarina, who is the muse for the character Keita, whose story is told in this novel. Keita's mother-in-law, the other Catherine, is also based on a direct ancestor of Lauren's. Both characters have deeply traumatic histories to contend with, providing blistering action and plot. And Lauren imagines from those histories credible psychological journeys for her characters that give this novel really powerful substance. It's a pleasure to have Lauren join us for the show. Tēnā koe. Welcome to Bookends.
Tēnā koe. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Wow, Lauren, there is so much rich, sad story in the lives of these two women. How does it feel to bring them to life in this way as fictional characters based on your ancestors?
You know, as you say, they did have hard lives, and it was an absolute delight to give myself the permission to delve into the experiences that might have had. And I think the thing, when I look back on my whakapapa, when I look back on history and so many of these stories of all of our ancestors, the thing that really is remarkable to me is just how resilient a lot of them were as well. Mm. Like, I know we speak often about how hard the world is now. You know, people say the world's a dumpster fire right now. But as a historian, I would argue that while this may sometimes feel true, there's been a lot of dumpster fires, a lot in human history. And there's been a lot of people that have had to contend with situations that we can't even conceive of.
Yeah. That responsibility that you talk about to kind of honour the past like that and to recognise that what we're going through today, there's been iterations of it before, it's not just a personal responsibility to your ancestry, is it? It's kind of inevitably political too, I imagine. You know, our history lends itself to being told in historical fiction, and you seem to be really embracing that. Can you just talk to us about when you decided that these stories needed to be told, and how you knew that that was what you had a calling to do?
Look, I love history. I'm a history nerd from way back. I've got a lot of history nerds in my family. And one thing that's always frustrated me, I think, and this was especially true when I was younger, when I was a kid, when I was at high school during the 90s, was this general feeling that existed in New Zealand at the time that our history was boring, it was meaningless, and there was no point in learning about it. And this is, I guess, it frustrated me, not because I could see the richness and the interest in it, also because it's our history. This is where we are now. And the other thing that's always frustrated me about this narrative about New Zealand history not being interesting is I would argue that all history is interesting. And just because you choose to focus on, say, Aotearoa New Zealand history doesn't mean you can't also read about Henry VIII's wives. Like, it's kind of an and to me. And there's so much historic fiction out there set around the world, and I just really wanted to do something that was here because these are our stories.
Yeah, and they're very fresh, I find. Like, we experience the telling of them as really fresh. It's even though there's so much power in, you know, Henry VIII's wives or some of that amazing, you know, global history that we think about impactful history from a world scale, this history feels really fresh, and it does feel really impactful for what we're still experiencing in Aotearoa today.
Yeah, and absolutely. And the thing that is exciting about New Zealand history and understanding a little bit more about it, especially through the fictionalised lens, is it just brings it alive. But this is our whenua, this is our land, and one privilege we have being in New Zealand, learning New Zealand history, is we can visit the sites where things happened. We can see things in museums that were relevant to them. We don't have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars to go somewhere else to walk across foreign battlefields, which is very interesting and also worthwhile doing. But it is here. It is in our backyard.
Yeah, for sure. And so in this, we've got this interweaving between kind of she's not actually a colonial figure, is she? The other Catherine is brought as a convict.
Yeah, she's a convict.
Yeah, so, but this kind of Pākehā woman story of oppression, and then a Māori, her daughter-in-law, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, daughter-in-law,
yes, it is.
Keita, the intertwining of their stories. Did you discover them simultaneously in researching your own whakapapa? How did you come across their stories?
I think it always... The Other Catherine is a fictional book. It's based on the broad events that happened in a couple of my ancestors' lives. But I had to take the decision at some point during one of the very early drafts, actually, to fictionalise their lives, partly because I didn't want to take liberties. You know, I've got a lot of whānau and I didn't want to make family gatherings too awkward.
Kia ora.
And I think from a narrative point of view, I did, but they were greatly inspired by this woman. And the thing that really struck me when I was researching the space between back in 2022, this was when I came across a record of a convict ancestor of mine, and I'd never heard of her before. And while I'd had a vague idea that we had some convicts in our whakapapa, I found it quite confronting because she was a Keenan. She bore my name. She never got married, so she kept the Keenan name. This entire time, I thought that my surname was fully, like, from a patriarchal line, but it wasn't. It was this woman that I'd never heard of before, and it was delving into her life and asking myself the question, why have I never heard of her before? We've got a lot of family stories. Why wasn't she in them?
Then the material that you came up with about the journeys of women like your ancestor is so incredibly confronting, and what those women had to deal with, you know. And I loved your opening comment that we think that the world's a dumpster fire today and that we need resilience to survive today, but you know, and there are people who experience real trauma today, many living in all sorts of traumatic situations, but these women survived them almost like a matter of routine. You know, it was kind of expected that their lives would be this tough.
You know, I especially, you know, the combat part of the book, Catherine's story, she was on a transport for 7 to 8 months. That's a long time to be in a ship below deck. And I was on this really rough inter-islander crossing last year. It was so rough. We all lay on the floor and you could just smell the vomit. And it was just one of those times where you just feel absolutely thoroughly miserable and pukey. And it was when I was writing one of the early drafts of The Other Catherine, and I just couldn't imagine how it would feel having to do that for months and months and months and months for a reason that was completely outside of your control. You know, Catherine stole a coat. She was 18. You know, when I was 18, I didn't get sentenced as a convict. I can't even imagine how frightened she must have been. And but yet these women, they do forge these bonds. And researching the convicts, researching this woman, one thing that does come through is these bonds that they did share with each other. And that was something, the power of female friendship was something I really wanted to capture in this book.
Yeah. No, I think that you have done that really well.
Thank you.
Surviving with friendship. And then the intersection of that with Te Atiawa Ki Taranaki's own history, you know, and the with Catherine's son marrying into your Māori whakapapa, that's an amazing story too. And it also intersects with an earlier novel of yours, and or not novel, you, with your guidebook about musket wars.
Can yes, you just it does.
Talk to us about how this connects to your whakapapa.
Yeah, well, no te atiawa o Ngati Tuiti o te atiawa o. You know, my hapu Ngati Tuiti in 1832, the Waikato invaded, and it triggered a hiki. It triggered people to leave Ngā Mutu and leave New Plymouth. And that story is a big part of our story as an iwi, because it didn't have an indirect consequence when it came to the later Wakefield settlers that came in the later New Zealand wars. And the story of what happened in the 1830s has just swirled around me my entire life.
Mm.
It's a story that's told and told and told because of what it meant for us as an iwi. And the other thing that was particularly remarkable about this particular invasion was my tupuna and my Pākehā tupuna was there. A lot of the white guys from the boat, they had cannons. They fought alongside the Te Atiawa. And it's just a moment in history that I find really interesting.
So fascinating.
To that.
Mm. Yeah, no, there's it really is, isn't it? It's almost like you could have imagined a different Aotearoa forward from that time than the way that things played out. Yeah. Just and so it really does feel like a remarkable story to have access to and to have brought to the page.
And one thing that fascinates me about history is people are a bridge to another time. You know, I was, when I was one, my grandpa passed. He was born in 1914. You know, his grandparents were born a lot of time before that. And when you start counting it back with people's lives, those events aren't actually as far away as sometimes they feel.
And I absolutely, that's what I feel like when reading Aotearoa historical fiction. What's so powerful for me is just how fresh it feels, like how we can still trace the story in the people around us, you know. Yeah. And as you say, this is history that swirled around you as a child, you know. It is still really fresh. I guess reading your notes at the back of the book, which is a great section. Yeah. Thank you for including that. I was astonished by how much material there was for you to pull together, a narrative that was really soundly historically based. But I'm also intrigued by those decisions about how and why to fictionalise. So, because there's so much material there, but you had to imagine yourself into character.
Yes.
And so talk to me about that decision. What's it like as an author? When do you know what you've got to fictionalize and which parts of the history to keep true and just kind of narrate, if you like?
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. I think as a historic fiction writer, the first thing you have to do is, you know, the historic fiction is a broad church. There's a lot of types. And I think from the outset, you almost have to decide, are you at, you know, there's the luminaries, right? There's one end of the spectrum. The amount of research Eleanor Catton did is just immense. You know, we've got the Hilary Mantel books there too. They're really, really detailed, but some also find them less accessible, not because they're not good books. And on the other end of the spectrum, we've got, say, the Bridgerton books, you know. I mean, not going to lie, I read all of the Bridgerton books in lockdown.
But are they actually historical fiction? I mean, is there much history there, or is that just their setting? You know what I mean? Like, they're not telling really much of a historical story.
They don't tell a historical story. You know, it's funny, I'd never intended to be a Bridgerton defender, but they do tell a story of woman power dynamics is the framing for a lot of those novels that wouldn't exist in the current time, I suppose.
Yeah.
In a lot of bodice ripping and all the other stuff.
Yeah.
But I think you need to decide where you sit kind of on that spectrum first. And for me, I kind of wanted to be in the middle because I want my stories to be accessible, but I do want them to be historically accurate. And I have to make a lot of decisions because I strongly believe I owe a duty of care to the readers, and I also owe a duty of care to the people that lived before me, you know, the tūpuna who sit on my shoulders, to not take liberties with their lives and their experiences. So when I choose to turn something into fiction rather than non-fiction or more accurate historical fact, it's because I'm uncomfortable with the need to take liberty for narrative reasons, which is why ultimately these stories were inspired by my ancestors, but they're not about my ancestors.
Got it. Thank you for that. Thanks for that insight into what's going on for you. The Bridgerton reference, and not to trivialise it back to that, but deciding where you stand on that, from Bridgerton's to, say, Wolf Hall.
Luminaries.
Yeah, or luminaries. One of the things that struck me about these is I want to know how you feel about your covers, your cover images. You know why I'm asking, don't you? And it's about that contextualizing in that scale of things here, because I think a lot of literary fiction readers might skim past your novels on the shelf, thinking that they were bodice rippers. But then on the other hand, a lot of people who love and just read for that light distraction and love historical context for that will pick them up and will read them and will maybe gain more. So, but tell me how you feel about your covers.
Oh, how long have you got? I think there's a broader issue at play here, which is the shorthands that are used to sell books, but also the shorthands that readers use to buy books.
Yeah.
You know, when The Space Between came about, looking at covers, and I said to my husband as a joke, oh, I bet this cover's going to have two women staring into the distance. And it did.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Taken from behind over their shoulder, and one's got the shawl draped, you know, that kind of thing. It felt archetypal.
I felt, though, I had strong views. I didn't want anyone's face showing. Because I don't like that on covers. I don't like to imagine the characters.
Interesting.
I mean, this is a how books are marketed versus how they are. And like I said earlier, historic fiction is such a broad church. It's tricky too, because there's also a disconnect, I suppose, between literary fiction and commercial fiction. And I'm definitely marketed and am on the commercial fiction side of the ledger.
Indeed, although I think, you know, anybody interested in reading, anybody who enjoys literary fiction will find plenty to enjoy in novels. And they're beautifully written, they're well-crafted, and the characters feel full and fully realised, and the history is so relevant. So I guess...
Yeah, maybe in time, I don't get much of a say over my covers.
Sure.
I get presented with shortlisted options. I read voraciously myself, and I make decisions sometimes based on covers.
Yeah.
Sometimes the kind of books I choose to read, like I said, there's a kind of an intellectual shorthand. You go, oh, this is a this, this is a that, this is a this. And I think that, unfortunately, in this day and age, as a writer, we're dealing with so many different kinds of media. We're competing for attention.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the reasons why these intellectual shorthands exist. You walk into a bookshop and you go, oh, I like this book, and this book's kind of got a similar cover. I'll probably like it too. And on one hand, it sells books, but on the other hand, it in the absence of knowing more about a book, you know, we don't have the reviewing culture internationally has definitely decreased. Word of mouth is still the biggest indicator of success of books. Yeah. Word of mouth over a very long period of time.
Yeah, for sure. That shorthand, as you say, it communicates so much. And I just, big shout out to listeners to look past the covers on these ones, because there's so much value in them. Too much of a distraction there with my question about covers, but I couldn't help it.
That's a great question.
I couldn't help myself. There's just one other thing I'd love for you to talk about, and it's such a dark place that both women spend time in this story. Ultimately, their journey moves, and Kate's journey moves her beyond that. But it's it is dark. And I wondered, because it's your own whakapapa that you're drawing on to some extent, did it cost you psychologically to spend a lot of time in those dark stories?
It's an amazing question, because it kind of does. And I've developed some kind of protocols around writing, I think. Like, I won't write at night, because there are times, especially when I write at night, that you can feel a bit haunted.
Mm.
And I definitely needed to kind of go through a process for that when you're channeling these kind of feelings.
Mm.
When you're trying to channel, especially around grief. But not writing at night is one of my rules.
Mm.
Because I used to, earlier in my career, and I used to feel really, I don't know, I kind of get the heebie-jeebies sometimes, just because it's really hard to kind of disconnect from that. Sometimes you literally do need to touch grass.
Kia ora. Thank you. Thanks. And I think the book has a slight feel of that the haunting quality of these women's characters really comes through. Ngā mihi so for joining us,
you.
For your storytelling and sharing some of your process with us on the show. I've been speaking with Laura Keenan about her latest novel, The Other Catherine. It's published by Penguin, and it's available from bookstores nationwide. And look past those covers and have a read. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
The island has disappeared. The street is empty. I am silent like the second hand of a watch, like a telephone forgotten on a table. Why are you so quiet? He suddenly asks, reaching for the phone and holding it as if it could tell and retell the future.
That was Diana Hawken reading from her latest collection of poetry, Peace and Quiet. Diana's work is marked by her succinct and insightful writing, her use of imagery set in the natural world, and this can be at times unsettling, but it is almost always reassuring. Her poetry connects us strongly to the known, but hints at the magic and the unexpected, proving that work such as hers is vital in turbulent times. Dinah won the, or was given the Prime Minister's Award for poetry last year, and I can't think of a better recipient. Welcome, Dinah.
Thank you very much.
I know how apt, having read this new collection several times, I know how apt the title is. Because,
oh, good.
Yeah, peace you is has multiple meanings for you in your poems, and quiet is very much part of who you are and what your writing contains.
Yes, I'm glad you see that.
Yes, the piece, you live on the Paekakariki coast, on at the Kapiti coast. So, as I said, natural imagery just is everywhere in your poems. Was it there at the beginning?
I think it was, though I don't think I recognised it because I have a scene in my mind where probably about my third book, Water Leaves Stones, listen to the title, Greg O'Brien launched it and called me a nature poet. And I thought, gosh, yes, that's what I am. I hadn't approached poetry as thinking that I was a nature poet, but I think very much that I am.
You are, yes. But what drew you to poetry in the beginning?
Well, I often think that the fact that my father, who was a farmer, read A.A. Milne night after night often to me and my siblings, or probably just me and my sister, but just that, the rhythm and the rhyme, and made a big impression on me. And the fact that my father kind of turned into another person when he read poetry.
What a lovely thing to start you off. I certainly had a father who was a farmer and read that book to me as well.
Oh, great. Yeah. But I actually didn't start writing till I was about 35. It didn't occur to me that I was capable. Being a poet seemed something other people did. The turning point really for taking it seriously, like many others, was Bill Manhire's creative writing course at Victoria. And that was great. And you set me off for a lot of poetry workshops and readings, etc., in New York, which happened soon after Bill's course. So
you would have met many like minds too, I imagine.
Yes, absolutely. Some people a bit disparaging at writing workshops, but I've just got so much out of them in New York as well as here.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, they are, as you say, places that you get a huge amount of help with your poetry, but exposure to other people's poetry. And even, as you say, you might have had disparaging comments. You often, I imagine, learn from those as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. No, and I had the chance later on in my career, I suppose, to teach for about 7 years in the IIML in Victoria, and a course called Writing the Landscape, which suited me very well.
Yes, well, that that reinforces Greg's description of you, really.
Yes, yeah.
You also, in your earlier work, I'm not saying there aren't hints of it in here, but you were also a keen sailor or went sailing a lot, so you had, you know, a more intimate experience with the water.
No, I haven't ever been a sailor, but I have
Why did I think you had?
Well, there are a lot of poems about a lake.
Oh.
And yes, I've been out on a lake quite often, on someone else's boat or rowing a boat, but no, I haven't been a sailor.
Well, I'm muddling you with someone else, but water, of course, in all its forms, you obviously go down to the, living by the coast, you not only watch it, but you go down to it.
I do, and I do pretty much every day, so I feel very, very lucky to be retired in a place like this.
And, you know, watching water brings you back inevitably to what is inevitable in the world. What, you know, watching a tide come in and out.
I mean, yes. At least there's continuity there.
Yes, and it, not always in the world, as we know. But
that's right. Yeah.
Your, you know, very strong poems about peace, about pacifism. There's a couple of longer poems. You know, you've got these sections where you've got quite short, very to the point poems, but you've put two longer poems, especially the one in the middle that looks,
yes,
is very much about parihaka, the voices of people that we all know, Vera Brittain, Virginia Woolf, Archie, Baxter. Tell me about the inspiration that you got from, how would you say his name? Is it Motsi or Mozzie?
Mozzie. I don't know how to pronounce it, actually.
Because no.
The starting point for that poem was a book I read years ago called Nonviolence, The History of a Dangerous Idea by Mark Kolansky. And Mark Kolansky quotes Motsi, and that's where I got the quote from, or part of it. But that whole poem contains, I worked out, something like over 20 quotes or voices. And it's my poem, but it's not my poem. So some those voices, I hope, to have sort of integrated into the long sequence.
It's a real plea for peace, for people to change how they do things, to, you know, listen to wise words.
Yes. And there are quite a lot of wise words around, but we tend to be in too much of a hurry to hear them, maybe.
Yeah, because we don't stop and take, you know, give ourselves silence in this busy world. And that, I think that's another huge part of your poetry, isn't it? To encourage people to just be still and listen.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. And I realise I'm not going to do anything differently in my 80s. I have at the beginning sort of made that decision about this book. This is where I am with the natural world and as a peace-loving, gentle creature. And that's what I've got to offer.
Well, it's still as strong and as powerful and as timely as ever. Those things never go in and or out of fashion.
Yes.
What do you get solace from?
Well, quite obviously the natural world, very much so. And I do things that are quietening as well. For example, I've been doing Tai Chi for about 40 years, and that is a way of becoming quieter quite instantly for me now. And a few friends and I have a meditation group on Sunday nights, so we just sit and listen to a talk and meditate, but that's another quietening activity.
Tai Chi is part of the inspiration for your last poem as well, isn't it?
It is.
The movements, the rhythm, the turning, the...
Yes. One of the things about that poem is it feels a bit unfinished. For example, I've only written in response to about a half of the Tai Chi form, but obviously one of the characteristics of Tai Chi is continuity, and I think I've been able to capture that to some extent in the poem. But the other characteristic I haven't been able to manage, and probably wouldn't ever in poetry, is the slowness, the slow. No, I don't think you can ask a reader to read that poem slowly.
Yes, because I won't even say I tried Tai Chi. I went to a couple of lessons. It was a long time ago and things got in my way. But you're right. It's you hold poses, don't you? You don't rush from one to the other.
Yes, no, it's and the slowness is a crucial part of it, really. So in that sense, the poem has failed, but I think hopefully it still offers something.
Oh, more than something. At our age of life, death is all around us. It's something that's familiar, but it's still shocking. So a number of these poems deal with death, with people going, with memories, with, you know, our own immortality.
Yes. And in that sense, it's autobiographical, but only not altogether. But I think I'm hoping that people in their 70s and 80s may feel there's some fellow experience going on.
I think it would be hugely comforting for those who are grieving to read your poems, and for those of us who may be temporarily not grieving.
Yeah.
Because it's just a temporary, it's a part of our lives to,
yes,
to have. Isn't it?
Yes, it is, and it gets kind of buried in the sense of all those ads for active retirement villages. And there's a sense that we're not quite living up to or facing up to this stage of life. And I guess that's what I'm trying to do. And poetry helps.
Well, it can say things that those of us who are not writers, you know, can't adequately put into words. So thank you for doing that. There's many poems I would ask you to read, but I rather liked the lovely short poem called The Tray. I wondered if you might read that for us just to finish.
Right. My daughter had a good reaction to this since she knows that tray very well. The Tray. He brings up the morning coffee on the faded red tray that for decades our right hands have gripped, raised, and carried towards each other through the compatible air.
I think it's particularly poignant, that last line, the compatible air. It says so much in just three short words. Thank you for your time, your talent, all that you've done for poetry in Aotearoa. I can't think of a more worthy recipient for the Prime Minister's award.
Oh, that's very nice of you, Maureen. And I think I have somehow had contact with you way back.
Yes, yes.
And so it feels very fitting and very gratifying to have you somehow tuning into these poems.
They, I think it sounds a bit of a cliche, but they certainly speak to me in my time of life. So I know they will to many others. And yeah. I will be looking forward to many more poems from you, Dinah.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
The book is called Peace and Quiet. It's written by, well, no, the poems are by Dinah Hawken, and it's published by Te Heringa Waka Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
All Her Lives is the intriguing title of Ingrid Horrocks's first collection of short stories. Ingrid has previously written memoir, literary history, and poetry. Last year, she was the writer-in-residence at the IIML, and this year she's about to go to Australia, to the Michael King Writers' Centre, to be the writer-in-residence there. Ingrid, the obvious question to start this off is fiction. What drew you to it? Have you been writing it for ages, or is this a new venture?
Yeah, kia ora. So nice to be here. It took me a long time. So I did write fiction in my 20s, and I did publish a few stories, and, you know, they were in Landfall, and it seemed like I should keep going. But there was something in me that thought I didn't have anything to write about, which I think is quite common for maybe particularly for women in their early 20s. And then at some point in my early 40s, I decided I was going to do whatever I wanted, and it turned out I wanted to write fiction. I've been reading fiction passionately all my life, and short stories is an obvious place to start. I needed to teach myself how to do some things.
Yeah, these are linked in lots of different ways, not obviously, because they don't lead one on to the other, and the times chronologically you've mixed them up. So give us a sense of how it was to structure the book.
Yes, so from the very beginning, when I realised it was a book, I had this idea of 9 stories, 9 women, 9 different moments in history, and 9 different life stages, which is part of why it took me about 5 years once I had imagined the book to actually write it. And I didn't think they would be linked at first. It's just that I'd written some historical stories and I'd written some contemporary stories, and I wanted to feel how women's lives might echo together across time. But I also didn't want them to be chronological, because I felt as though if I began with Mary Wollstonecraft, which is the earliest story in the 18th century, and we moved forward, I felt as though it would suggest some kind of nice progressive developmental narrative in women's experience. And unfortunately, that didn't seem right to me. So I wanted kind of moments and challenges that were different in different moments. And then the characters started appearing in different stories. So I had a moment when I had Madeline, who is a activist in 1980s Devonport, in one story, and I was starting to write a story about another woman who was older, and I thought, oh, it's Madeline. And then it's this glorious thing that you know someone when they were 26, 27, and then this incredible pleasure about thinking, oh, what are they like when they're 70? And what is the world like, and how is it different? And maybe if I give them that story, what will that feel like?
Yeah, there's a real delight when you, as you're reading through, to realise that you can catch up on other people's stories, and that, you know, comes as a surprise to the reader, which is really, you know, heartening in lots of ways to see became of people.
Mm. Yeah, the idea of, I think it is heartening. I think that's a really nice word for it. So I feel like, so there's a peripheral character, May, who's just a young mother in the first story, Evie on Branch. And for me, there was a lovely realisation that she could appear in a later story as this kind of formidable family friend.
Mm.
And you think, oh, that's who May is.
And Evie, from that story, you get a little glimpse into what happened to her as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing about a short story, is that it feels so contained. So Evie on Branch, Evie is queer and she's come back to her family farm in 1919. And the story is just one afternoon. And that kind of, you don't know if she'll stay on the farm, what will that will mean for her queer identity, and then you get this little glimpse later on about what might have happened, whether her lover might have been part of her life. And, so kind of it's kind of joy in the richness of our lives.
I love that opening story because the way you described her coming home to the farm and seeing it with new eyes after having been at the war as a nurse, there was something, and having grown up on a farm myself, it was just beautifully evoked, the sense of the farm, the physicality of the place.
It helps that that's actually my farm, essentially, where I grew up, north of Masterton. So that I do know that landscape. And that story comes from having seen a set of photographs of farming life in the sort of early 20th century, and this really striking photograph of a young woman sitting on a branch. And it's so beautiful. And I started imagining, what was it like for a young woman a century earlier than when I was living on that farm? And also in the photograph, it's very clear that the felling of that farm is happening in that moment. So also what did that landscape and transition feel like, and how isolated it was in the 20th century. But it's also a landscape I both love and I've left.
It comes through, and it's interesting that it was your farm because, you know, there are very strong emotions evoked, as I say, in that story of her coming back. And there are things that are so familiar to her, but things that have changed as well. I have to say, one of the stories that really resonated with me was the one set in Truby King's garden. And because I was brought up as a Plunkett child, had it drummed into me that you couldn't spoil babies. But I hadn't realised how, you know, I knew what a strong influence he'd had over generations of New Zealanders. But I hadn't realised that he had those views on women's education.
No, and neither did I. So that story started from a sense that there was this garden that has his mausoleum at the centre, and that it had a hospital and it had babies. And so it was sort of a way of thinking about the history of New Zealand women's lives. But the more I read biographies and read some of the quotations from his writing, it's pretty extreme. And then I spent a lot of time in the National Library looking at pamphlets and, you know, some things, very strange ideas, like the fact that blood would be drained from the womb if women did too much thinking. So we wouldn't, and that it would also is quite deeply linked into eugenics. And so basically white women needed to produce babies and they needed to bring them up in a particular way. So it's really interesting that Plunkett has been trying to sort of remake themselves and has actually publicly talked about this issue with Truby King. But I didn't want to write a story about Truby King, which is why I stepped sideways and I wrote a story about the little girls growing up in the garden.
Yeah, and one of them being really affected by coming across, you know, what he said about women's education, learning, that it would basically destroy them, and they had to put it aside and bring up children for the empire.
Yes. And I did want, you know, I was quite shocked reading those pamphlets myself, even though, I mean, we know about the history of sexism.
Yes,
but
yes.
It's sort of just when it's so naked. I think that's what we're not used to seeing, and the clarity of his views alongside the books that he was writing that were being sent to every mother. So I was sort of imagining what does it mean for a teenager to encounter that? And to have imagined, so this story is set in the 1930s, so she's good at school, this girl, Kina, and to have imagined that was considered worthwhile, and then to read these pamphlets written by a man she knows and think, oh, that's what he really thinks.
Yeah. Very shocking, as you say. Tell me about your interest in Mary Wollstonecraft, because I don't know enough about her.
Yeah, yes. So she's one of my obsessions since my 20s, really. And so Mary Wollstonecraft is most famous for writing The Vindication of the Rights of Men in the wake of the French Revolution. And then thinking, oh, hang on, wait a minute. And then she wrote The Vindication of the Rights of Women. So it is kind of that foundational feminist text. And I think there are a few things that fascinated me about her. One is that she had this big discussion of reason, and then her life is a complete disaster. So her feelings, I think, as a young person, realizing that actually life was more complex than setting things up. And also that she's writing in a moment where she thought the French Revolution would change all their lives, and particularly women's. And it didn't. And it didn't enough. And so she's writing in a moment of sort of desolation, both personal and political. And so I'm interested in that. But then once I was writing fiction, I just felt like there was a story in that. So that story, I had to work really hard to find the moment. So it's just 3 days. Mary Wollstonecraft, sailing around Norway, looking for a lost cargo from a silver ship. And the silver ship kind of becomes the metaphor for what she's lost, which is her love, her kind of political idealism. And at the same time, she's there. It's beautiful. She's embodied. She's strong. She's got this incredible mind. She's missing her baby. So I actually loved writing that.
Yes. Again, the place is so much part of that story. As you say, it's beautiful. It's remote. It's surprising to her. And so that, you know, becomes very much part of the story as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. And there is a lot of desolation in the stories, but I also wanted there to be this kind of sense of pleasure, and that these women had these sets of circumstances around them that are putting pressure on them, but nonetheless they're living their lives and they are themselves, and they're in their place. And so I think for me, often the place is part of what provided the consolation and the beauty in the stories.
Yeah.
Which I think is true for a lot of us.
Of course it is. That's why we live where we live. It's why we go to the places we go to. And people like you immerse yourself in water. I do. Yes. I do when the water's warm.
Yeah, it was pretty chilly this morning.
Yeah, I bet. I have huge admiration for people who swim all year round. I always mean to, but somehow I give up. Now, the other story that I had real resonance for me, because I'd probably around about the same age, was the one set in Devonport, the one, you know, where you alluded to at the beginning, of the awakening of a woman to what she could be through, you know, becoming part of a women's group and banning nuclear ships in the 1980s. So, yeah.
I'm really pleased you like that because, you know, that's in some ways that's it's my mother's generation there, and I'm writing into a space that so many people know that time very well. We did live in Devonport in the 1980s, so again, it's an area that I know. But I just love the idea that Devonport has the naval base and it also had the anti-nuclear movement, and that everyone's kind of living alongside each other. So putting a kind of that story puts pressure on a relationship. So the conservative husband and then the woman who is actually finding herself through all these other means. And actually this one, I have to say, this is my Trump story because I kept thinking, what is it like in America to be in one of those marriages where someone has become obsessed in that space, and how do you live intimately with someone where their political views on the entire world are kind of opposed to yours? And so that was really fun for me to think through that. And I like her husband.
He's a decent guy.
And that took a lot of writing to get there. I don't know that they can live together.
And we get a glimpse of her life again, as you said, later on. So, you know, which is really satisfying.
Yeah. I think she's really amazing, Diana. So we meet her in this little moment where she's not yet strong enough to leave. She's also pregnant with twins.
Yes.
So I had this idea in my mind that even if she thought she would leave, I have twins.
Yeah,
I wouldn't leave. You need a partner. It's helpful to have a partner when you have twin babies. So she needed longer to actually be able to leave. But I think stories can go into the pivotal moment where the mind changes, even if you're not yet ready to change your life.
Yeah, the ending of that story is perfect, really, because it must be hard to decide where the perfect place is to. You know, get out. And she gets out of a situation and she realizes that things have changed emotionally and mentally for her.
Yes. And also it was important to me that the activists in that story weren't also all good. You know, they're all complex, compromised characters.
Yes. They sure are. Yes, they are in life.
They are. They certainly are. And quite funny. I hope that story's quite funny.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. There's so much in each story that is, you know, rooted in real life, but, you know, real life has humour, lots of humour, lots of black humour. Just to end, tell us about going to the Michael King Writers' Centre.
Yeah, so actually it's a relationship that the Michael King Writers Centre in Devonport has with the Varuna National Writers House in the Blue Mountains. So every year the Michael King Writers Centre, in collaboration with Australian Arts Council, I think, sends one New Zealand writer to the Blue Mountains for a month. And we live in a house with six other writers, I think, which is going to be great because usually as writers we get sent off on our own. And I participate in the Blue Mountain Writers Festival and other readings in Sydney. And I'm writing a novel. And the novel is the story of Diana, the Devonport woman. It's her babies. Her babies all grown up in their 50s in
contemporary times.
Contemporary New Zealand.
There's lots to wrestle with there, Ingrid.
There is. I like the big topics.
Oh, well, that's wonderful news. I'm thrilled. I'll look forward to that. And I hope your experience over there will be really useful, but inspiring, challenging, all those things.
Yeah, it'll be fantastic. Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you.
Yes, lovely to talk to you too. Ingrid's book is called All Her Lives. There are 9 stories. It's by Ingrid Horrocks, of course, and it's published by Te Herenga Waka Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.